Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
This is The Counter-Ruck, a Six Nations podcast brought to you by the Irish Times in association with Nifty Business. I'm your host, Nathan Johns, and given that it is England week, Ireland are travelling to Twickenham this Saturday, we have a very special guest on today. Joining myself and Gordon Darcy is former England captain and a World Cup winner, Lawrence Dallaglio. We start things off by taking Lawrence back to the start of his international career, where, in a perhaps different universe, he could have played for Ireland.
Going back a number of years, there was a possibility you nearly played for Ireland.
Yes, I did actually.
So you got a phone call from Noisy Murphy?
I did, yeah. I think it's probably a well-told story, but I was eligible for the Italian rugby team and for Ireland. And obviously getting in the England team in the early 90s was pretty difficult. And I got a phone call from Noisy, and my mum, she said, there's an Irish guy on the phone, can't understand a word he's saying. He sounds like he's from Cork. In true Noisy fashion, he definitely sweet-talked me. He said, hello, Lawrence, he said, we've heard you like a few pints of the black stuff. How would you like to wear the green shirt of Ireland? That was his initial chat-up line, which I think was quite impressive, really.
Did he intentionally sound like a leprechaun, or was that just...
Well, I don't know. I can't do a Cork accent, but I mean, obviously my mum's mother was from Mallow in Cork, so I could have played for Ireland. Well, I was very flattered, actually, because I was trying to get in the England team, but Ireland were not the side they are now, obviously. I think they had a slightly different
you can
motto.
Say it.
I think it was kick ahead, any head was the motto in those days. But I think they... There's certainly a different outfit. But look, you know, I was born in London. I wanted to play for England. And if I hadn't got in the England team, I'd have desperately begged to get in the Ireland team. And they'd have probably said no.
Yeah, it's only just because I was just, as you do when you get guests on, you have a quick Google and see what are the interesting bits that you can talk about, such as this. But it's the fact that the call from England came 24 hours later, according to this story in The Guardian that I'm reading. That doesn't sound like too much of a coincidence.
It was about 24 months later, actually, to be honest with you. But I was, I was lucky enough to start my England career. As Darce would tell you, the post-match celebrations were slightly different in the early 90s or mid-90s. And I think I was up on top table with Noisy, having beaten Warren Gatland's Ireland side, as Austin Healey was being stretched out unconscious from being awarded his first cap at the dinner. And I think Noisy leaned over and said, Lal, we nearly had you, boy. We nearly had you. But I had a great relationship with a lot of the Irish players and a lot of the team. And it was great to meet Darce properly before the Lions tour. He probably felt like he had his dad on tour with him or something. I was laying out my kit, but
all those kids playing today, all those consummate professionals, never had the pleasure of having to toast. So I think the tradition I was referring to is when you got your first cap, you had to go up on stage, get your cap, and sometimes sing a song, depending on what it were. But in the post-match, it was all a black tie function. You would be toasted a drink by all of your own teammates and all of the opposition. So you were pretty much drinking like 21 players, 22 players back then. So like 43 drinks, if I can add correctly. Very few players lasted the full evening.
Survived.
So Austin Healey was unconscious, not because of the rugby. I thought that's what you were saying. He was unconscious because of the after.
Yes.
Right, that makes a lot more sense. Yeah, you mentioned it there. 2005 Lions is when you guys got to know each other properly. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, so like I would have played against Lawrence at various stages there at club, and once previously before that Lions in 2004 when we beat England in Twickenham, which was my first Six Nations, which was obviously good for me, not so good for Lawrence, but they had a World Cup, so not going to feel too sorry for them. But like thrown into a room together in the Vale of Glamorgan, and I was like, oh, like a bit of a short straw in with this lad's English thing. And then you spend like a little bit of time in his company and you're just like, oh my God, another one of these English lads that I hate on the field, but I really actually enjoy spending time with him. So we had a good week in Wales, and I remember it was you, me, Neil Back and Josh Lucy all went out for a few beers, and a few beers turned into considerably more than a few beers in Cardiff. And next morning, like, I woke up and rough, I was like, oof, this is going to hurt today. And he's been up on the treadmill, like 6:30, like hammering it out. I was like, oh my God.
I think we had, I remember being at the bar, we had Alistair Campbell on that tour, that ill-fated tour. And, you know, he was kind of quite shocked that the four of us were going to go out for a couple of pints, you know. Anyway, it was a great experience. Sadly, I only lasted about another 2 weeks after that.
Yeah, what was the injury? You broke something.
Yeah, I broke my ankle in Bay of Plenty. I think we made a good start to the tour. I was going running across the field. There's a lot of rain on the pitch, a lot of dew on the pitch, and I went to help Dricko make a tackle, which was, you know, probably not needed. Got my studs caught in the ground and broke my ankle. And I remember James Robson, who's just I think retired, isn't he, from the Scotland medical team. He came on and he actually put my ankle back into place. I remember taking my shirt off for some reason and giving it to the guy as I came off the pitch. I said, look, hang that on the peg of the guy I'm playing against because I'm sure he'll want that. And it was just a quick, funny story. I got to hospital with Gary O'Driscoll, the Lions doctor, who's now obviously with Arsenal and earning considerably more than he was in rugby. But he's a great man. And there was a young junior orthopaedic surgeon left in the hospital. He's about 18. And he said, mate, he said, I've just seen it on the telly. He said, I reckon you fractured, dislocated your ankle. And I was lying there with my foot at sort of right angles. I said, yeah, no shit, Sherlock. Well done. And then he's looked at me, and you know, Darce will tell you this, how passionate the Kiwis are about rugby. He's looking at me, and I'm in my full Lions kit, just come off the pitch, minus my shirt. And he just said, can I have your kit? Which I was quite astounded by. So I said, so listen, do me a favour. You go and get me some morphine. I said, you can have the whole kit back. So, anyway, listen, the rest is history. I had a plate in my leg. Sadly, Brian O'Driscoll joined me about a week later, didn't he, after the Maori game. And
the infamous.
It's mad because there was so many players on the tour. Because we'd gone out with like, and listen, you try something, it works, it doesn't work. You know, we tried something very different on that Lions tour, not a lot of players. But the amount of players that, still the turnover in players that were on the tour. But I think there was obviously Lawrence around the peak of his powers, but like Richard Hill as well. Like he lost so many influential players that would have been more, you would think would have been in the test squad. And, you know, would that have made a difference? Who knows? Like, as Lawrence, one of the things I was saying to Nathan was, we just happened to be in New Zealand against possibly one of the best teams, versions of the All Blacks in the professional era.
Yeah, they were a very good side. They'd obviously, you know, massively disappointed at being, beaten in the World Cup in 03. And they were determined to win. And, you know, as you said, McCaw, Carter, I don't think it was, you know, this is no disrespect to any of us, but I don't think it was the best Six Nations Championship in 2005. I think Wales won with a Gavin Henson penalty. Ireland and England had probably disappointing outings. So I'm not sure we necessarily had the weapons that we needed to go and, you know, beat New Zealand. Because if your captain, Brian O'Driscoll, gets injured, taken out by, you know, Umanga and Mielamu, then really the New Zealand captain that day, I think, scored two tries and went on to be man of the match. And he probably shouldn't have seen half-time, really. So I just don't think physically we were in the battle, really.
Was there a leadership vacuum on that tour because the likes of Lawrence and Brian were taken out so early?
Yeah, possibly. But I think, like, Lawrence is painting the picture, you know, regardless of what we had done, were we in the best shape going there? I think that was definitely a contributing factor. You know, you've lost pretty much all your kind of key leaders across the way. Individually, okay, but then, you know, the challenge of the Lions is you bring four different playing styles together. You got to do it quickly. And, you know, we were continually disrupted. And that's why I think, you know, the 2009 Lions benefited from that experience. It needed to be tried. It needed to be tested. And then you kind of take the bits, like everything that work, and you kind of move on.
When you say it needed to be tested, are you talking about the squad size? Because it was, I think there was like 44 players. It was huge.
But it was, and that's the thing, it was a decision taken and we all bought into it. It was like we were going to have two teams. You were going to play your way up or play your way down. As it went out, the closer you got to the tests, you kind of knew which squad you were in. And that was about keeping players fresh for the tests.
I think the approach was probably the wrong approach from Clive Woodward. I think he would admit that now. He may not. I don't know. But certainly, having been on previous tours in 97 and 2001, you know, we handled things very differently. And I think Warren Gatland kind of re-established what the concept was all about. You know, you never run with someone from the same country, you know, and you really foster that kind of that spirit that you need to. And I'm fascinated to see how Andy Farrell takes it on, because, you know, he's been part of that Lions experience. He's been involved in, you know, Great Britain Rugby League squad. He fully understands, you know, how to bring people together, as you can see from what he's doing with Ireland. So great appointment. Very excited to see how he goes and see if he picks his son.
Picks his son.
Well, we'll talk about that in a few minutes, but I'll get your thoughts on the leadership side of things and kind of moving on from that with the English team and leadership within the current English team and even in the kind of last 10 years or so in English rugby. But I suppose a good place to start is really, you know, what's your initial reaction to the loss against Scotland?
First time since 1896, I believe, that they've lost four championship matches in a row to Scotland.
If I'm honest with you, it probably didn't come as a great surprise. I think they went into the game, Scotland as 7-4 favourites to actually win. I mean, obviously, I'm disappointed as an England fan because, you know, I think we have to measure or rein back on what we feel is successful as an England team at the moment. They're in transition. It's post-World Cup. They're still trying to find their DNA as a playing group. I think the coaches are still sort of coming together. It's a new coaching team, a lot of new players. And so for me, success for England was probably winning more games than they lost. And for the last 3 years in the Six Nations, they've managed to win two and lose three, which is not a great record and not something we should be terribly proud of. But you're not suddenly going to go from that situation to winning every game. So I didn't expect them to win the championship or a Grand Slam or even be competing at the on the last weekend. So for me, winning three games, it would be successful. I did feel that they might beat Scotland away because of the motivation of having lost three before that. I think the fact, for me personally, the game was always much more emotional, much more spiritual. And obviously Jamie George, the captain of England, you know, fantastic job that he did to even play the game, given that he lost his mother the week before. And I don't know, I just felt that England had enough in them to win that game. And they started very well. And if I was one of the senior players, of which there were many, you know, you look at Jamie George, Itoje, Danny Kerr, George Ford, Henry Slade, these are guys that have all over 50, 60, 70 caps. I think when you get yourself into the position that they did, they probably should have played a little bit more responsibly.
From the outside looking in, and I think your point ties into that, Lawrence, it looks like they're just a little bit muddled in what they're trying to do. I mean, that first score in the first, five or six minutes, the first phase strike, brilliant running lines, cut Scotland open, fantastic, right? Completely different to what we saw from England during the World Cup. But then with 10 minutes to go and they're 9 points down, they're continually box kicking. And I think there was a video on Twitter that counted how much time they actually wasted in that last 10 minutes box kicking. And it's kind of like they just seem to be a little bit caught between two different styles at the minute. Is that fair enough?
I think that for the last 4 years, England, since Japan, have not really settled on their identity really as a group. You know, Eddie Jones had 23 assistant coaches in 6 years. And I think, you know, Darce will tell you that to build a successful team, you need, in my opinion, a couple of things. You need trust and you need consistency. You need to trust a group of players and you need to be consistent with the messaging that they receive and kind of, you know, gradually add on layers. You know, I played 85 times for England. I didn't play very well in every game. I could have easily been dropped more than once. But I think England, under Eddie Jones, used 108 players and 23 different coaches. So I think what Steve Borthwick inherited was quite a confused group of individuals who didn't really understand what they were being asked to do necessarily, because it kept changing all the time. And I think that Steve settled on a style of play which is very effective, driven by data, selection driven by data. But ultimately, he himself has recognised the need to to sort of change England's style. And you're right, they are still evolving. They're still a little bit confused. And ultimately, I think they made, 33 unforced errors. And if you do that at that level, Scotland had, three or four chances and scored them all.
Kind of adding into that, are they picking the right players? So it's kind of, it's two things, isn't it? Really, you've got the style, which is maybe being driven by, or the philosophy, which is being driven by data, which is one thing. But then you also, selection-wise, are the right players being picked across the board? Because I do wonder, is George Ford the right option at 10 at the moment? Because if you look at most other halfback pairings in the world, you need to be much more of a threat with the ball in hand.
I mean, listen, I think that, this year, across all the Six Nations, it's been interesting, isn't it? Because the number 10s have been a massive talking point. You know, Wales have moved on with Dan Biggar. France, Entermac's injured and they've had problems. You know, with Owen Farrell deciding to take a step back, you know, it was always going to be a void for England. Marcus Smith injured. And obviously Johnny Sexton, you know, stepping down after an incredible career. But the way Ireland played, Johnny Sexton's not even in the conversation, really, about the fact that he missed him. Whereas with England, it's you know, a continual sort of talking point. My theory is that England's problems are more up front than anything else. The game has become about power and about size. And, I'm not sure we necessarily, or understanding of what you're doing. And I'm not sure we quite have that game line success. You know, Ireland, you look at the detail that they have in there, in the way that they get themselves over the game line. They don't power themselves forward. They use footwork, they use skill, they use innovation, they use movement. And when you're playing against a team that are bigger and better than you in certain ways, I think England could be a bit more innovative in terms of the way that they play. And selection, there's one or two players that maybe aren't in the squad that could be, but by and large, I think they're picking the right players. They just need to kind of free themselves of this kind of fear of failure, really. And there's a lot more potential in the team, I think, than what we're seeing at the moment. I think they know that. Steve knows that. I probably would have picked Finn Smith at fly half, but, different selections.
Lawrence, you were talking about power there, and that's really, really interesting, because I've been thinking about this a lot recently and watching Ireland on the weekend and, you know, that bench that they brought on in the forwards. We've been talking about that a lot in previous discussions. But it's not that long ago that Ireland would go over towards the end of the Joe Schmidt era, beginning of the Andy Farrell era, you know, memories of going over to Twickenham and just being physically beaten. I mean, poor old Manu Tuilagi, I think he delayed Ross Byrne's international career by a few years by just running over him quite a few times in a World Cup warm-up. The dial feels like it's kind of shifted, doesn't it, in terms of that kind of power aspect. I mean, Ireland are never going to be the biggest side in the world, especially in the forwards, but they certainly seem to have gone the other way on that in that conversation.
When you think of power, you immediately think of the Springboks and France, really. And the game is both sides of the ball. And some of those teams have got the ball carriers that, you know, when they get to the advantage line, they're able to, you know, they're able to get over the advantage line. And more importantly, when they get over the ball, you know, it's very hard to shift big guys off the ball in terms of, because you have to be so precise now with your clear out. Ireland have still got powerful runners. I mean, I think, you know, you see what they did with their scrum, but they also, you know, clearly use, you know, better running lines, a bit more footwork. There's different ways of getting over the advantage line. But what I would say is, if you look at the stats, you know, England have really struggled with the game line, with, you know, getting any forward momentum into their game. And as a result, you know, the talking point is always around who plays 10. And if you're going to produce that kind of ball, then Marcus Smith is not a magician. There's no point in having him at 10, because, you know, he's just going to do the odd thing here and there with a bit of front football. I think England's problems are more up front than anything else. They need more bulk and power and footwork in the forwards, and they need a little bit more pace in their backs. But other than that, they're in great shape.
Not to go too deep into this, but is it a frustration then that there's probably, you know, the top ball carriers possibly in the Premiership are largely not available to England? And is that pathway... So you look in Ireland, we're very limited with overseas players that are not eligible for Ireland. The system is designed to contribute, you know, international players to the Irish system. Is that something that the Premiership have gotten a little bit wrong, perhaps?
Well, when your national team is successful, everyone, well, you know, in 2003, we were a good side for many, many few years, and everyone talked about how wonderful the Premiership was. and how broken every other league and structure is. And, you know, everyone focuses on Ireland and France now because they're doing very well nationally and saying, you know, maybe the top 14 and the way that Ireland structure their leagues is right. I think that there's some very good players in England, and for whatever reason, they're not they're not maximising their potential. And you know, you want to see performances at international level that are superior to what you see week in, week out at club level. And if that's not happening, then you know it's the coaches that have to take responsibility, but it's also the players as well. You know, it's up to them to challenge the coaches in a way that that allows them to realise their potential.
I'll continue my chat with Gordon Darcy and Lawrence Dallaglio after this short break.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome back to the Counter Rock. My name is Nathan Johns. I'm still here with Gordon Darcy and World Cup winner Lawrence Dallaglio as we chat all things England versus Ireland.
The script kind of writes itself if you're in an English camp, doesn't it, this week?
If you look at the fixtures that England had, they probably on paper had the perfect kind of, you know, no disrespect to any other side, but I mean, you could swap Ireland and France around, but the fixtures got harder and harder. You know, they started with Italy, then they play Wales, then Scotland. And obviously you would say that if they can't beat Scotland, then, you know, they're in for a hiding in the next, in the last couple of games. Whichever way you look at it, Ireland, even at Twickenham, will be a tough game for England. But listen, as I said, I'm not in their camp, but I would expect to win at home, no matter who you're playing, really.
And that's the bit, isn't it? You go into that. You talked about it. You said when we did play back in the day, there was more emotional energy. So you were much more light on structure. There was much more focus on passion and representing your country. And those, I suppose, emotional and emotive focus. That's what I mean by the script almost writes itself for the English camp in the build-up to this match, because they say, no, this isn't about tactics, this is about a bit of ticker.
The point of that is, and this is kind of ties into another question I had, and we might as well get into this now. I mean, it's not a round five game, so it's not the same situation as last year when England were going to Dublin aiming to deny them a Grand Slam. But obviously, if they win in what was it, round four, they're still denying Ireland a Grand Slam. There's a bit of history between Ireland and England in terms of denying each other Grand Slams. 2001, the famous foot and mouth delayed game. Keith Wood ran over the top of, I can't remember who he ran over the top of, but he scored a try and Ireland denied England the Grand Slam. But then 2 years later, you got your revenge. You beat Ireland in Dublin. I think that was the infamous red carpet game. You batted Ireland 42-6. How much of a motivation is that when you know the opposition is going for something that you were aiming for at the beginning of the tournament, which is a Grand Slam?
You have to find your own motivation and collectively for every single game. You know, Scotland, I would have thought England would have been incredibly well motivated because they weren't going up there to spoil the party. They were going up there to try and win something they haven't won for 3 years. So, listen, we all lose games of rugby. I lost many, but what you have to do is you have to bottle up that painful feeling of losing. And then when you play the same team a year later, 2 years later, you remember those feelings and you use them to inspire you. And as Darcy has already said, the game is very tactical, it's very technical, but it's still, you know, we measure everything in rugby. We measure, you know, how fast people run, what they lift, you know, all those sorts of things. But the two things you can't measure is what's going on in there, which is your heart, and what's going on up top in your head. And, you know, you can play against a side that are better than you, and Ireland are infinitely better than England at the minute. But the best side doesn't always win if you can connect the head and the heart in the right way. And I don't know whether my philosophy and approach is outdated now, because maybe you have to keep slightly more calm, you know, and before the kickoff, because if you get yourself overexcited, you end up with a red card quite easily. But what you can't do is be beaten emotionally and mentally. And so much about winning is believing you can win. And if this team, walk out on the pitch at Twickenham truly believing they can win, then anything and everything is possible.
Have Wales laid a bit of a template for England, and watching that, going, if you stay in the hunt with Ireland, don't over-resource rooks, stay not conservative, but stay measured in defence, you can frustrate the Irish attack. And then look at, say, the areas that Wales struggled in, was when they had the ball, they had to be more crucial. So it kind of goes, it lays down the template for England to say, well, listen, if we can stymie the Irish attack, and when we get opportunities, those one or two opportunities, if we take them, then we can potentially win that momentum battle. And that's where the belief comes from, really, Lawrence, isn't it?
Yeah, and listen, that's the game of rugby at the moment. Whether you think it's a good watch or not, no matter who you are, you're going to be a side that are probably going to create and have six or seven opportunities to score in a game. You know, there's this area between the 2-22s, and whether you run the ball or kick it, it's up to you, really. But actually, you will get down the other end of the field and you will have opportunities. And the difference between Wales and Ireland is that Ireland were able to take those opportunities. Wales went up the other end, had two or three, one just before half time, didn't take it, didn't get on the scoreboard. Ireland go up the other end and do. And England will have those opportunities, no doubt. And, like you said, they've got to make sure they take them and build that scoreboard pressure, and then do what they did to South Africa in the semi-final, which is defend, heroically and shut Ireland out. But the problem they have is that they're trying to change a lot of things in that team defensively and in attack. And inevitably, as good as international players are, there's a few mistakes that have crept in, and it's cost them against sides who haven't even got the sort of potent attacking threats that Ireland do. So that's why I think, if England are to win, they've got to come up with something that maybe surprises Ireland a little bit. There's nothing wrong with a wee bit of innovation these days. I remember the first line out in 2019 in the Aviva came straight over the top to Tuilagi, and it probably wasn't what Ireland were expecting. And maybe just from a mental point of view, they never recovered in that game. So I just think there's things you can do to unsettle your opponent, particularly when you know that they're better than you, really.
I think, they kind of have to, because everything being even, Ireland win this game. Like, you're probably one step, maybe two steps away from backs of the wall thing for this group. There's an awful lot of unfriendly scrutiny now coming in. And even for Borthwick now, at this stage, he's been in the job over a year now. It's getting what he wants, is getting time with players. But unfortunately, it is a results-driven game. So I think that adds a lovely air of jeopardy to the match. Ireland definitely going to increase the focus that maybe they didn't have, that little attention to detail or that sharpness going into the Welsh game. You would expect that will be there for this game. And there was a huge motivator. Fear is a fantastic motivator for teams.
If you look at Ireland, I mean, apart from the one game against New Zealand in the quarterfinal, and on reflection, I'm sure there's one or two players that might have done a couple of things slightly differently in that game, particularly in the first half, maybe kicked a few more points. I lost a Grand Slam, on my own against Wales for not kicking penalty goals. But apart from that, Ireland have been exceptional. I mean, what have they won? 20 games, except for that one game. And I was so impressed mentally at how they came back from the World Cup, and were able to pick up almost where they left off. And if anything, some of the players that, really stepped forward and produced some incredible performances. And what they've got is, there's other young players coming through, almost like we saw with Liverpool the other day in the cup final, they're willing to put players into the team should they be required. And everyone knows what they're doing. There's an understanding. There seems to be a lot of smiles on a lot of faces. And ultimately, that's what the game's all about.
What about leadership within a squad and everything like that? So again, you look at the continuation in Ireland, you've got Johnny Sexton, Peter O'Mahony, he's come in, and he is the, for me anyway, was the only natural leader within that group, and kind of it had to be him. And sometimes leadership gets, or captains and on-field leaders gets kind of glossed over. And again, like when we were playing against England, you know, the early 2000s, you know, you had players like Martin Johnson, Lawrence, Richard, well, maybe not Hilly, but back. And the amount of times playing against you, Lawrence, used to go over and almost put an arm around the referee and this lovely little patronising voice, "Is everything okay, sir?" And, you know, or over to a ruck patting me on the head, "Hey, Rumi, how are you getting on?" And like, you just wanted to explode on a pitch. But a lot of it is around knowing the right thing to do at the right time. And they're obviously the funny examples. But playing with Paul O'Connell, the team sheet says this, but the feel of the game is we've got a tiny little advantage in them all. So backs, good night and good luck. We're keeping this ball and we're going to go for it. Is there enough of that, say, within the English team at the moment? Is the, you know, that individual responsibility, leadership, whatever you want to call it?
No, I don't think there is. I think it's a very good point you make. I mean, I think, you know, the most successful teams in the world are coach-led, but they're player-driven. The coach is not the guy who gets his face smashed in at 3 o'clock. So there's only so much that the coach can do. The best teams get coaches that challenge the players, the senior players and the playing group. But then the players are able to feel like there's a pathway to challenge the coach back as well. And I think sometimes a lot of coaches like to have total control. I think when Ireland were playing under Joe Schmidt, you could argue that there was an element of control within the group, which is fine. We all need that. We all need structure and process, etc. But I see with Andy taking over, there's still that element of structure and control, but there's a freedom maybe within that framework to do things that they weren't doing previously. And I think England have had just so much structure and control. And I don't think the senior players, I mean, I can't believe that you can get to the number of caps that all that senior group have got against Scotland and not have the confidence to either challenge what you're doing or to change what you're doing during the game. You know, I'd have a number 10 if we're getting beaten up front, that would make, and I'm sure, you know, Johnny Sexton and many others were similar, would leave you in no uncertain terms as to what, you know, what was happening, and sort yourselves out. And equally, you know, as you say, as a forward pack, if you're giving your ball to the backs and they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing or what you want them to do, then don't give it to them for the next 10 minutes and they'll soon work it out. So I think there is leaders within that group, but for whatever reason, their voices have been muted for quite a while, and it's going to take a bit of time for them to develop that relationship.
Yeah, it's interesting what you say about the forwards giving the ball to the backs when they shouldn't. You almost saw that with France in the last round, didn't you? In the first half, they just picked the biggest possible pack that they could. They dominated, but any time the ball went out wide to the backs, they spilled it, and they're missing their two halfbacks. And you go, and right, if they had slightly more experienced halfbacks, do they just say, "Lads, stop giving us the ball. You've got Bosolo Tuilagi in there, tearing up trees. Just go for it." Anyway, we're coming towards the end. Before we go, Darcy, you'll be over in Twickenham working, won't you?
I will, yeah. I'm cycling with Rob Wainwright from Oban in Scotland down to Rome. I think we get in Friday at about 3 o'clock, and then I'm hopping on a plane back to the UK for Ireland versus Twickenham.
Will you be there, Lawrence?
Gordon and I are very lucky to work with Twickenham for ITV. Fortunately now, the panel's a bit more balanced. We've got some Irish people as well as some English people that are talking about the game. So, no, Darcy's been commentating for many years, hasn't he? So, I've had the pleasure of commentating with him. Sadly, I'm not sure I've seen England win in that time, but Darcy will be commentating, and I'll be keeping Brian company probably in the studio or pitch side with Rory Best and maybe Johnny Wilkinson as well, yeah.
It's quite a panel, that.
It is.
Quite a lot of
name
dropping going
absolutely.
On there. So go on, I'll ask you both the same question. Call it for me. Does a 2 week break, does that give like Felix Jones, gives him time to do his magic, bring in some of his Springbok ingenuity? You know, we talked about being innovative and surprising Ireland. Does he come up with something and that gets England over the line?
As I said, we were kind of talking about this sets the script for England. They are by virtue of that result, they are forced to deliver a passionate performance. They have to tap into that emotional thing. Winning at home in front of their own crowd is a huge motivator thing. I think that keeps them in the game. I still think Ireland win, but it will be an awful lot closer. Perhaps I would say, I wouldn't say that there will be more than 4 or 5 points in it, but I still think there's enough in this Irish team.
Lawrence, the last two games between these two countries, England have had two red cards. If they keep 15 on the field, do they? Because that's the argument that people have made here, actually. If it wasn't for the Stewart card and the Ewells card in Twickenham 2 years ago, we could be having very different conversations. How much of a factor is that? And do you think if they keep 15 on the field, there's a challenge there?
There's always a chance, isn't there? But I mean, I think this Ireland side, if we're honest, are a long way ahead of England at the moment. For lots of different reasons, which we don't need to go into. But England's record at Twickenham is poor. I think they've won 4 out of 11. And, so it's not the sort of place that holds any fear for anyone, let alone Ireland. So I think, for me, England have to win one of the next two games. And actually, I see them having more chance of winning in Lille against the French side than I do at Twickenham. So talk about head and heart. I mean, you obviously know where my heart wants. My heart wants England to win. I've connected it to my head, and my head says that Ireland will win, probably by a couple of scores at least.
Right, well, on that note, Lawrence, thank you so much for your time today.
Pleasure, thank you. It's always good to talk to you guys, and Darcy, I'll see you at Twickenham.
See you there, buddy.
Thank you for listening to this Monday's edition of The Counter Ruck, sponsored by Nifty Business. My thanks to Gordon Darcy and Lawrence Dallaglio. My name is Nathan Johns. Make sure you leave us a rating and subscribe to The Counter Ruck wherever you get your podcasts.